Oxide Radio, Oxford University's only student-run radio station.
Hello and welcome to Oxide Radio. This is Theo Davis-Lewis, your station manager on Oxford Today this evening. And we've had a wide range of guests so far on the show. We've had the Bishop of Oxford on, the director of the Ashmolean. We've had Ivor Roberts, a former diplomat, talking about the issues that we are facing today in global diplomacy. But we haven't actually looked at Oxford, and we haven't looked at radio in Oxford and broadcasting and journalism. And as many of you will know, that Oxide has relaunched in the last few weeks, successfully, I might add. And it's been something that's been quite a rewarding thing to do, because Oxford's always had a strange relationship with student broadcasting. And there's nobody who knows that perhaps better than me, bar Nick Robinson, the former political editor of the BBC, a presenter of the Today programme on BBC Radio 4. And I'm delighted and somewhat surprised to say that Nick is in the studio with me today. Mr. Nick Robinson, welcome to the show.
Well, it's a great pleasure to be here, and it's a surprise to me as well, because when I was here all those years ago, you'll no doubt remind me of how long ago it was in a second, I did dream of an Oxford student radio station. There was a little bit of Radio Oxford that allowed people to do some broadcasting, and indeed lots of distinguished radio men and women learnt their trade there, but there wasn't one dedicated to students, and we may talk about, I tried and failed to set it up.
So, actually, that's sort of the whole basis of the beginning of this interview, because when I was sort of reading your book, Live from Downing Street, which was, you know, sort of released a few years ago now, you talk about how you were involved in the Oxford Union debating the sort of Prime Minister of New Zealand at the time, and sort of getting involved with student politics. You sort of didn't really get the sort of highs of journalism in Oxford. And your point on student radio is that law and technology, as you tweeted me, didn't allow for it. You know, what was exactly going through your head? What were you sending letters to people? What was sort of going on?
Well, at the time, you know, hard though it is to believe, just keep reminding yourself there was no internet. So radio was radio. In other words, it had to come out of your radio. And at the time, the law didn't allow that. We all know that there was a thing called pirate radio. Radio Caroline still exists. At the time, was a kind of illegal station. But there was a change made to the law under the Thatcher government back in the early 80s to try and bring about something called community radio. So the idea is it would be hyper-local, if you like. So not even as big as something like Radio Oxford, on a much smaller scale. And I wrote to government departments, I seem to remember. I wrote to people saying, look, why can't we have one for Oxford students? That is absolutely ideal. We are, you know, a community of people. And the truth is, the technology would have been very expensive to develop at that time. The legal framework wasn't very clear. And I just remember having a whole batch full of letters and never actually quite making it.
Did they reply to you then or not?
Oh, yeah. I got into communication about what would be and what wouldn't be legal. But it was very, very new. And in a sense, the whole thing, quite quickly after I left, when the internet began in the early 90s, I left here in 86, in a sense became irrelevant, because that was the way you could have community channels, community networks, which you can do online instead of actually having to crowd out what was appearing on your radio.
So I suppose the next best thing for you then, if you couldn't sort of do what I sort of try and do on here, when I sort of debate people and I question them and I interview them, was actually student politics and the union, and that was something that facilitated that.
Well, the funny thing is, I did love journalism, and I sort of knew before I came here that I wanted to be a journalist, and people are often surprised by that, because I was a dreadful student political hack. I'm going to apologise now, you know, you're probably going to remind me that not only did I do the union, yes, I was actually I've got a lot of mates now who are at Oxford the same time as me, who I didn't know at the time, and we've spent quite a lot of time over quite a few bottles of wine saying, God, we would have hated each other if we'd known each other at Oxford, because they would have loathed my politics at the time, let me stress, and I probably would have loathed theirs in truth. But for some reason, I got sucked into student politics, and I didn't really write for ISIS or write for Charwell. Quite awkwardly, they wrote about me, which was a bit worrying. Indeed, there's a rather famous and award-winning journalist called Christina Lamb, OBE, I think she is these days, who rightly has been celebrated, who wrote something about the fact I hadn't paid for my lunch because I'd forgotten to sign in at Univ when I was supposed to, which produced a whole gag about there's no such thing as a free lunch, Nick. So I'm glad she made a career out of it. And a certain Evan Davis then was editor of Jarwell. Yeah. Didn't know him at the time at all, wasn't at my college. But he revealed to me just a short while ago that it was actually him who decided to award me the unfortunate super gay pushy fresher of the year, from which, frankly, I've never quite recovered. I was devastated at the time. But I got that because I did a lot of debating. Mm. That's what I really did, and that's what I really loved. And in many ways, that taught me a lot of the skills. Student union debating, Oxford union debating taught me a lot of the skills that I use as an interviewer now.
And so did you ever think of going into politics then, just because you were so involved in it?
Oddly not. Nobody really believes this, but really genuinely not. I mean, it sucked up an enormous amount of my time. But I was clear that I wanted to be a journalist, and really because my best mate's dad was a very well-known journalist. In fact, funnily enough, did the job I now do. He was presenter of the Today programme, a man called Brian Redhead. Right, yeah. And he was the one who got me interested in journalism and made me want to do it. Mm. I didn't know that I would do it. I had no idea I could do it. But although I was passionate about politics and fascinated in it, never really thought of it as a career. And as while I was here, I applied for a BBC training scheme and was lucky enough to get it.
And looking at your time in Oxford generally then, and we know if you read the book that you tried to set up a student newspaper, and we won't go into the sort of success of that, but you studied PPE at Univ, and recently there's been some criticism of PPE in itself, like by Andrew Adonis, talking about how it's not really full of substance at all, you should be doing enough of the subject. What was your sort of academic experience of Oxford? Did you sort of get into the degree at all, or were you just doing what I do and not actually doing much
work? Yeah, terrible confession, I did far, far, far too little work. And the truth is, and I'm not just saying this, I actually now regret it. Mm. So I was the first of the generation who had divided seconds. Remember, at Oxford, you used to get a first, a second, or a third. It was at other universities that you got two twos, like you do now here, known at the time as a Desmond, after Desmond Tutu, the famous South African clergyman and politician. But I was the first of the generation to get a 2-2. And my tutor at college wrote me a letter, which I can almost remember word for word. I had it pinned up for a while. It went something along the lines of, this is not what we had expected when we invited you to join university college. I've no doubt it said something like this. I've no doubt that it won't hamper you on the road to fame and fortune. Perhaps you'll remember your old college now. Oh, your old college then. I'm sorry. Perhaps you'll remember your old college then. And you can see it really pissed me off, that letter. But he had a point that I should have worked harder. And I should have, not because working in itself is important, but what you realise when you leave this place, what you realise, like me, when you come back occasionally, is the minds that are here, the opportunity to hear from and to engage with some of the great minds, not just of Oxford, not just of the country, but of the world, is crazy not to take every single part of that opportunity if you can.
I'm sure your old tutor now would sort of recognise that you have not done badly for yourself at all. Most people,
I think he was teasing me. I think he thought I was determined to get. And of course I did engage. You can engage in more than one way. Mm. I mean, you, by interviewing, not me for goodness sake, but some of the people you interview here, are learning and engaging with people in a way that, is not academic, but is something that Oxford gives you the chance to do. Mm. You mentioned in the introduction, I debated at the Oxford Union with, at one stage, the New Zealand Prime Minister. He said just before he died that it was the single most important speech he'd ever given in his life, David Longy. He defended the policy he had. He was the first socialist Prime Minister of New Zealand, of a nuclear-free New Zealand. And I still remember standing up in that debate and knowing that every word we were speaking was being broadcast live, not just in New Zealand, but throughout Australasia, because this was a profoundly important moment. And in those days, there weren't these little vans with satellite trays. There were enormous cranes on St. Michael Street, outside the Oxford Union, beaming this stuff back. And there was that sense of, this is a privilege. But I'll never forget, at the end of that debate, he said, David Longy said to me, if you're ever in New Zealand, you must look me up. And I remember saying, no, look, you're the Prime Minister. And I'm 19 or 20 or whatever it was. And his aide came up to me and said, he meant it. Sadly, I never did. I did get to go to New Zealand, but by then he'd already died, unfortunately.
And talk about sort of what the technology was like back then and how it's changed, because what people know you as really is sort of the political editor really of ITV and BBC. And so through your time really in the 21st century being a political editor, how have you seen the technological sort of aspects of TV and radio change?
Well, I'm hesitant to sound like one of the four Yorkshiremen in that famous Monty Python sketch, or maybe it isn't famous anymore, but there is a sketch in which the four Yorkshiremen played by Monty Python compete about how rough it were in my day. You know, I lived in a tin can. And I feel that when I describe the media as it was when I was here, that I probably sound like that. But it is worth reminding yourself that when I was at Oxford, there were three television channels. Three. That was it. BBC One, ITV, and BBC Two, of course. And it was an exciting moment, actually. I think it was either here, when I just arrived, that Channel 4 came on. It was a long time until satellite television came on in the early 90s and multi-channel. And, of course, no internet. And it means that things like an Apple or a BlackBerry or a Galaxy, they were things you ate. They were not things you carried in your pocket. And the reason that matters is it means that people had remarkably little choice about where they got information, where they got news from. You basically got it from the BBC or you got it from ITN. And now, of course, the big transformation is that if you look at your phone, the information you might get could be false. It could be promoted by a foreign government. It could come from a hyper-partisan site. It could be very opinionated. It could be just what your mate spotted, even though there's no truth in it. Or, of course, it could be one of the alternative sources of news now, which are excellent, which social media has allowed the creation of. But it is a transformation.
So how do you see, then, the role of political editor now? Because, obviously, you're still at the forefront of political journalism with Today. But specifically with political editors then, do you think that role's going to change from what you did with it and what Andrew Marr did before you and what Laura Koonsberg's doing now because of how there's new technology, there's more social media involved with it?
Well, in one sense, it's bound to change as the audience for traditional television news bulletins get smaller. And they are. It's still high. You know, you'll still get between 4.5 and 6 million, I would guess. I haven't looked at the latest figures. 6 million on a big night, 4.5 on a more average night, watching the BBC 10 o'clock news. That's a big deal. And the person who stands outside Downing Street, the person who stands in the lobby of the House of Commons, as I used to and Laura Koonsberg now does, has extraordinary privilege and power to try and explain to a large audience of people what's going on. And in many ways, that role of political editor is like a sort of trusted guide. What people are effectively saying is, look, you know, I haven't got time to get my head around all this. And even if I had got time, I might not understand it all because, you know, you need sort of years of experience and knowledge to do it. Can you do it for me? And that will carry on being an important role, whether it's on a TV news bulletin or on my radio programme, which, remember, is 60 years old, the Today programme, but it's just recorded recently its record ever audiences. It's about 8 million people in a week, 3.5 million people at any time during its most popular moments. These are big numbers of people. But what Laura has to do, what I did as political editor, is in addition to that, you've got to be on Facebook, you've got to be on Twitter, you've got to find different ways to broadcast. Now, I think the really interesting thing for your generation, when you, if you go on and be a journalist as I am, will be whether the new media changes the way the old media looks and sounds. In other words, the kind of video that we now see on social media, which tends to be short, has text at the bottom, maybe that will completely revolutionise the traditional TV news package, which is very different. And it kind of should, because TV news still looks and sounds pretty much as it did when I was here at Oxford back in the 1980s. And I can't imagine that's going to carry on for that much longer.
And you've also talked about how the BBC and other broadcasters need to remake the case, really, for impartiality. And you talked about this in your Steve Hewlett lecture. You've also talked about it in the last chapter of your book as well a few years ago. What's the state of impartiality in broadcasting, you think, in this country after so much political events have happened in the recent few months?
Well, the thing is, this is another dramatic change in my lifetime. People of my age, I'm in my 50s, grew up without ever thinking about impartiality. It was just like the weather, it just was. In other words, that what you watched on the BBC and ITV in particular these were people, not who didn't have views. Of course people have views. There's no such thing as an impartial person. You can't search out and find someone who doesn't have political views, didn't have influences on them because of the religion they are, or the school they went to, the area they come from, the colour of their skin, their religion. Those people don't exist. Everybody is a combination of views and prejudices. What impartiality means is you come to work determined to and legally bound to try to put that to one side and do your best to find the truth of a story on any one day, admit that you might get it wrong, and if you get it wrong, see it as your duty to correct it as soon as you can and to do a better job the next time. That's what impartiality means. Now, of course, now, because of all that media that you can get online, some people prefer, they like to have media that sort of plays back their views at them, that reflects their prejudices. That allows a sort of depth sometimes that you can't get in mass media. You know, if you're gripped by the politics of the environment, you're always going to get more from a site that is dedicated to that, people who share your interest or obsession, than you, just like you would if you were following a site about Manchester United, frankly, than you would following a general thing, a general news programme like the BBC. But, and here's the but, I think if you look at the experience of Fox News in the States, if you look at the fact that Trump supporters get their information from one place and Trump critics get their information from somewhere else, if you understand that means there are no shared facts in American public life, you can't really have a debate about anything because nobody agrees what it is you're debating about. There's no agreed premise for a debate about whether to reform healthcare, for example. That, I think, is very, very dangerous. And I think this country benefits from the fact there is still a place where national debates happen. But the decision is for your generation. Do you still think that's important? Or do you think complete freedom of speech, like you get in print, is preferable? And it is a choice, let's be clear. There's a downside to impartiality. Some people think it's not really achieved by the BBC. Some people think it's a distortion of the debate. Some people say they prefer to get their news in a different way. But remember what you're giving up when you say that. What you're giving up is the idea that there is a shared space for debate and discussion at which people of very different views agree that they should meet in one place, have a conversation, have a debate in one place, and try and resolve their differences. Now, for me, that's the basis of democracy. That's how democracy works. I mean, there is a reason when I show people around, as I occasionally do, the House of Commons. One of the little weirdnesses about the House of Commons is the red line in the carpet. There are two red lines, one on each side, near to where those dispatch boxes are. And people often ask me, well, what's the red line for? They are to keep people two swords' lengths apart. So in the old days when people carried a sword, the idea was debate replaces conflict. Debate replaces warfare. Debate replaces having a duel. And so if you kept people two sword lengths apart, they had to do it with the power of words, the power of argument, not with the power of violence. And you may think this is overstated, but I don't. I think if you get rid of the idea of a shared space for debate, the danger is people quite quickly come to the view that other people's views can be censored, ignored, shouted down, rather than engaged with.
And if you look at sort of Fox News in the UK, that's sort of just crumbling apart now because they're sort of pulling out of the UK. But looking then at the dynamic we have in the US.
Just hold on a second. We've got Fox News in Britain. It's just called RT.
Which is, well, it's a different sort of...
But my point is Fox News closed down, okay? And the reason why didn't Fox succeed, it's an American-only product, and we've got very right-wing newspapers, and therefore, in a sense, there wasn't a gap in the market, I suspect. But RT, Russia Today, let's remember what it stands for, is the equivalent of Fox News. Let's be clear, it's partisan, it's paid for by the Kremlin, it's run by the Kremlin, it is done for the Kremlin, it's propaganda. Doesn't mean that 90% of what you see might not sound and look and be pretty much like what you would hear on the BBC or hear on Sky News. But it's the 10% that matters. It's the 10% that is designed to put a positive gloss on the actions of a non-democratic state. It's the 10% designed to get people who are anti what is the kind of consensus view in Britain, because the view of the Kremlin is disrupting arguments, disrupting belief in the system, disrupting a sense that what we have in the UK delivers is a good thing. So we've got hyper-partisan.
So what do we do about them then? What do we do about them then?
Well, I think people have to get a bit more canny about it. They have to be a bit more alert to it, which is why I've done something that I don't normally do and I'm not normally allowed to do, which is to take a public opinion by criticising Alex Salmond, the former First Minister of Scotland, for taking a show on RT. He lends it credibility. Should he do it? No.
And if you look at, specifically with the US then, do you ever think, maybe in the case with RT as well, that we will see sort of a more democratic state in the channels there? Because, of course, there is a split between CNN, Fox News, MSNBC as well. You know, I suppose it's good to talk about how we can actually get a state which we have perhaps in the UK, where we do have, you know, impartial news, arguably with BBC and ITV and Sky. But is that achievable, really, in the next generation?
No. In America, no, because the genie's already out of the bottle. I mean, remember that in the United States, although they didn't have a public broadcaster, like the BBC. And remember, it is a public broadcaster. It's not a state broadcaster. The government doesn't pay for the BBC. License fee payers do. The government doesn't appoint the director general. An independent board appoints them. They're not a state broadcaster, the BBC. But they never had state or public. You know, lots of European countries have state broadcasters. The BBC, almost unique in having an independent public broadcaster. They never had that. But they're big broadcasters. ABC, NBC, CBS did believe in impartial news. The difficulty they've got is they're now operating in an environment of hyper-partisan news. Fox on the one hand, MSNBC, which is the liberal left alternative for many people to Fox. It's almost impossible to imagine them reversing that now. It's a change in the regulations that allowed to happen, and I can't imagine it'll be ever be reversed.
And focusing back perhaps on you then, because you sort of went from being political editor to Today, and Today is one of the most popular radio shows in the country, and everyone knows Today is 60th anniversary of the show. What's it been like making that transition? Because Roger Mosey talked about how you were destined to do it. and if anyone was destined to do the Today Show, it was Nick Robinson. I think that's a quote from one of the quotes from these articles I've been reading. Did you ever think about doing Today then, more than being a television reporter, which is normally associated?
Oh no, that was the job I wanted to do. Political editor was an accident that happened on the way.
Of course, yeah.
It really genuinely was. I mean, in the sense of, you know, my family had no background in journalism and no background in politics. But as I said, I had this mate whose dad,
Redhead, yeah,
Brian Redhead, was a top radio presenter. And he happened to be a mate's dad who I saw a lot because of the weird hours he did. I used to kind of see him on my way back from school from the age of 8 to 18. Mm. I went on holidays with them. You know, I knew him really well. So in a sense, I didn't have a kind of Michael Heseltine back of the envelope. It's always joked that, you know, he'd written on the back of an envelope at Oxford that he wanted to be Prime Minister. I really genuinely didn't have a plan, but it was kind of the dream. And I never believed I would be a political journalist, actually. I didn't. I was a producer for a decade. I worked on Panorama as deputy editor there. It was a real surprise that I ended up as a political journalist, and a bigger surprise that I ended up political editor, and an even bigger surprise that I did it on two channels. The thing I'd always thought about was presenting Today.
And how do you see the dynamic, perhaps, of radio changing then? Because we talked about how the systems of broadcasting are going to change, but you've got your own podcast now. Almost as many listeners as this show, maybe.
Hard to believe.
But no, you know, you've got that sort of political thinking podcast. You get, you know, you had Chuck O'Muna on there recently. You've had Ed Miliband. And as we were saying, you know, before, it's a way of engaging people, which is slightly different to what you normally have because it's a different audience as well, I suppose.
Yeah, podcasting I'd not done before. And I've always tried to start doing whatever is new. This was nothing, no thanks to me, by the way, but as it happens, I wrote the first political blog in Britain because someone clever at the BBC who understood this stuff said, oh, there's this stuff called blogging. I didn't even know what it was. And I started to do it. And then later he said, I think yours is the first political blog. I did 24-hour news when it was new. And I did Twitter very early on. I've always tried to kind of force myself to try whatever is new. And podcasting does two things. One, it reaches your generation much more effectively than radio. I've got kids who are university age. One is just left here at Oxford, another at the other place, Cambridge. And one who's still at school. And they listen to podcasts a lot more than my generation do. The other thing is it's more conversational because people tend to listen to podcasts in their earphones or headphones. And they're choosing to listen. It's not kind of on the background, in the background when you're having a shower, you know, or on the loo or doing the cooking. People tend to listen to it a bit more in a more focused way. And you can be more chatty and more conversational then as well, because people have chosen to make an appointment with you. So I do it because it's fun. I think the interesting thing is that going back to when I was here again, breakfast TV, I think, began while I was here, I think in the mid-80s.
Mm, TVAM and all
TVAM,
that.
TVAM, and people said, that's it for the Today programme. It's finished. People will, like they do in other countries, particularly in America, they'll watch their telly in the morning. Well, ladies and gentlemen, they don't. The Today programme still has a much bigger audience than breakfast TV. It's a habit. It's a convenience to listen to radio while you're busy getting ready for work or getting up or... you know, commuting or on your bike, you can listen to the radio in a way you can't watch the TV. And it taught me a lesson that you think you know where technology's going. And yes, we know change is dramatic, but actually radio, it's survived because it's incredibly convenient for people. And my guess is it will still survive for much, much longer.
Mm, and just to end then, looking specifically at today coming in, sort of to that setup, how was it then to sort of have the different personalities? You know, you have Humphreys and Michelle Hussein, you have all these sort of big characters, big names in the BBC. How does it all work? How do you sort of complement everything?
Well, the first thing to say is it was terrifying, you know, to go there. Although I'd done lots of broadcasting for a long time, it was kind of emotionally quite a big deal for me because I was taking my best friend's dad's job, as it were, all those years on. So it was a big deal for that reason. But yeah, you go alongside an icon like John Humphreys, who's been doing the job now for 30 years, and you think, God, this is a challenge. And what you know is, precisely because radio is that very intimate experience for people, you don't know how people are going to react. When I did a trial run on Today, I think it was about 15 years ago, I did a few days, there was definitely a quite a bad reaction from the audience. It was before I was political editor, so people didn't know who I was at all. Mm. I'd just been doing late night presenting on Radio 5 Live. And there was definitely a kind of, who's this kind of slightly northern bloke? I don't like him at all. And so you're nervous before you do that. And you need to also get the dynamic between the presenters right. But now, I'm comfortable. But of course that means when you're most likely to cock it up badly, get too relaxed, that's when you screw up.
So... final question, what is more intimidating, sitting in the studio with John Humphreys or sitting in a studio with me?
Well, of course with you, because I didn't know what you were going to ask.
Nick Robinson, thank you very much for your time.
Theo, thanks, and good luck to the radio station.
Oxide Radio, online and on demand. Listen back to all your favourite shows on oxideradio.live.